Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Jaron Benjamin, and I'm the Vice President for Community Mobilization at HousingWorks.
And so you were part of the big day of civil disobedience in the Capitol Hill around the healthcare bill this week, right?
That's correct.
All right. So tell us about how that went down. I think there's a pretty dramatic photo of you being carried out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, there was. And luckily, my wife, who gets nervous about demonstrations like this, was not watching, was working on her dissertation, and didn't see any of that stuff until I was out of jail.
All right. So, yeah, tell us about the day and how it went on.
Well, I mean, the day was pretty moving, and I think was probably as impactful for people that participated as it was for people who logged on and saw it on the news. I didn't expect that. When you get 150 or 200 activists or however many people we had in the room before we went to the Capitol, and a lot of these folks have either participated in protests, or, you know, since we had people from 21 different states, you would assume that people were already feeling as many feelings as they could feel,
right?
Because everybody in that room is dedicated and committed. But one of the themes that I noticed when I talked to people after being released from cuffs was that we all got way more emotional, not only throughout the day, but during the demonstration than we thought that we would. It turned out that we were more angry about this attempt to take away healthcare away from millions of people than we possibly knew. And we cared more, and we were moved to tears more during the protest. I think, you know, the day started off with about 150 folks getting together and just talking about why we were together, and then going over the scenarios, figuring out which constituencies would be able to go and have a demonstration at which offices at one time. I think to the untrained eye, it was chaotic, but to a lot of us, it was democracy in action. There were a couple of very moving moments during the day. I think one, when a mother from Arkansas, before we went over to the Capitol, just stood up and talked in very plain English. She didn't talk about what policy needed to be passed or what or exactly how much money was going to be cut from Medicaid or that the program would be transformed as we know it. But she just very plainly said, "I'm a mother who has children, and I'm concerned that that if Senator McConnell and his friends push this bill through, I won't be able to take care of my children. They have pre-existing conditions, and I'm worried about the safety of my children." And that really hit home for a lot of folks. I think most of us either started crying then or fought back sobs. I think that there was just something that really resonated with a lot of people there, that it was just like, we're just regular people who are concerned about our kids and our family members, and we just want people to stay alive. That's it.
Yeah.
Another really moving moment was when, while we were being processed and we're all in cuffs, about 85 or 82, I don't remember how many, but somewhere in the 80s, and we're all in the same room, and we're being processed, that spontaneously people started singing "This Land Is Your Land." And it really underscored just how we were, in a way, kind of, this protest was a dream of what we can accomplish when we're pushing to live the American dream and putting our minds together and fighting the good fight.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like healthcare is really has the potential to be that kind of issue for a lot of people who otherwise either wouldn't get involved, wouldn't risk arrest, wouldn't do things like this, or just, you know, wouldn't at all see themselves as part of a progressive movement.
Right. It's important to note that most of the people that got arrested had never been arrested before, had never done this before. There were a number of people that I knew that have been involved in this fight for the lives of low-income individuals living with HIV and AIDS, fighting to preserve those lives, fighting to safeguard healthcare protection, access to healthcare. That some of those folks who have been doing this since the 90s had not participated in civil disobedience, and that this is their first one.
Yeah.
And I think that this is an issue. This is a keystone issue for a number of reasons. One, just the fact that the lives of millions of people are at stake is very hard hitting and important to a lot of people.
Right.
I think that for people that are concerned about the new presidency and concerned about his rhetoric and the way that he carries himself and are just offended at the way that he conducts business, they understand that this is the first big thing that he and Senate leadership and Paul Ryan have decided to put on their docket. And the longer that this is fought back, pushed back, and delayed, the less successful they're going to be. And the more of our healthcare we will be able to preserve.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up because I think that there is this sort of tendency, and of course there's more big Russia news this week, talk about like the demeanor of Trump more than the actual policy goals, which are bigger than just Trump, right? That this is Mitch McConnell, like it's Paul Ryan, it's most of the Republican Party seems willing to vote for this thing, and we still don't know, how many of them are ultimately going to break.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that we're assuming that this is going to go down is that the further this moves along, we can't leave it up to chance that some Republicans, just of their own volition, will decide that this isn't right. We're going to break from the party. That they're not going to break from the party unless we get to them with the stories of their constituents and make them understand that this is flying in the face of doing your job. And that is a tall order because we've seen them go along with what President Trump says and excuse his behavior for a long time.
Yeah.
And, it's a scary moment. But again, the one thing that President Trump has promised that even some Democrats have said this isn't such a bad idea is his infrastructure plan. Well, he can't figure out how much money he's going to spend on infrastructure, or that the administration and leadership can't figure out how much money they're going to spend on infrastructure until they figure out how much money they're going to dole out in tax cuts for the super wealthy. Well, they can't figure that part out until they make huge cuts to the existing budget. And the only place that there is enough money and that they would be willing to make big enough cuts is in Medicaid and Medicare and the social safety net. So that this is delayed, and especially keeping in mind that most presidents get almost all, get their signature accomplishments started the first year of their presidency. The longer we're able to delay this, the more we're able to deal a blow to people who are trying to take, who are trying to get tax cuts away at the expense of the rest of us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting too because we don't talk about the way that healthcare is itself infrastructure, right? That this healthcare bill, among other things, would take away jobs from nurses and home healthcare aides.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, my father works in Oklahoma at a health center, and there are where my parents live is in southern Oklahoma, and there are a lot of folks who are on Medicaid and Medicare, who and who access these clinics. So it's really important for people to be able to, one, be employed, and then, two, be connected to healthcare, because, you know, we're talking about healthcare jobs, that's one thing. I think the other thing, too, is that if you're talking about investing in the country, if people aren't healthy, they're not healthy enough to work. If they can't stay healthy, they can't work. And so it really derails a lot of what we're trying to get accomplished, no matter what we're trying to get accomplished, if people just aren't connected to healthcare and aren't healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to ask you a little bit about the history of Housing Works, because obviously Housing Works has been connected to this fights around healthcare for a long time.
Yeah. The Housing Works was founded in 1991 by the Housing Committee of ACT UP. So there are usually four individuals that are credited with founding the organization. Our CEO and President Charles King, who I get to work with almost every day, unless he's in jail or in some other part of the country or in another country. And then our senior policy advisor, Jenny Schubert, was another founder. And both of them are still very, very much involved in these efforts today. Another one of the founders is Eric Sawyer, who currently works at GMHC, and he's great. I get to work with him a lot. The one founder who passed away was Keith Kyler, who is a partner at Charles King, and he was an incredible figure, and really, in a lot of ways, as does Charles, embodied the fighting spirit of Housing Works. And the idea was that if we could house people living with HIV or people with an AIDS diagnosis, then we would be much more successful in stabilizing them and getting them into treatment. Yeah. And in the early 90s, and maybe even 10 years ago when I started working on the issue, that was kind of a radical idea. Not everybody understood that. And people still don't understand that when someone is stably housed, they have a place to take their medicine, their lives are a lot more stable because they don't have to worry about where they're going to sleep tonight. They know where they're going to sleep tonight. They know where, possibly where their next meal is coming from. And then they can settle down a little bit and focus on making sure that they're taking their meds, making sure that they're making good health choices. And really, what we've seen, I think, as Housing Works has had victory after victory after victory and convincing the New York City and state government to invest more in housing services for people living with HIV, more in health services for people living with HIV, and people who are at risk of, when you talk about the at-risk population as well. What we saw was that Governor Cuomo in 2014 made New York the first state to commit to ending AIDS as an epidemic by a certain year. And so there's this great initiative that we've got here in New York State of ending AIDS as an epidemic by the year 2020, getting to below epidemic levels, so below 750 new infections by that year. And a lot of other states and jurisdictions have followed suit. There are more than a dozen jurisdictions, and there are places like New York, obviously, and San Francisco. Washington State has done it, and they're very far along. We were also seeing places like Illinois, Minnesota, Fulton County and Georgia, Texas is starting to try to figure this stuff out as well. We're seeing, places like Colorado, Pittsburgh. We're seeing a lot of places kind of follow suit. And that's something that we take very seriously, is the idea that we can end AIDS as an epidemic, even as we don't have a cure for HIV. Mm-hmm. And so that's the organization's history and kind of where we're headed. And I think that everybody involved in those struggles understands that if we lose Medicaid expansion and if people aren't connected to health care, then our, to routine healthcare especially, then our ability to fight HIV as an epidemic really becomes hamstrung. And so it is so important to hold on to the healthcare that we've got.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how the coalition of people that came together to do this action the other day came together and the networks that were at the heart of that.
Well, I think a lot of this started, and I hope that my colleague Paul Davis doesn't mind me sharing the story, but I think that this is, it's a very important story to share. It was early February, and, you know, it was about 11 o'clock at night, and he sends me a text, you know, that he just, like, can't stop crying because this article he read in the New York Times. And he sends me the article. The Times article was about the people who read letters that were sent to President Obama and were responsible for sending the president 10 letters a day. And the stories were heart-wrenching. And the stories, the story kind of showed you, took you behind the scenes and showed how this stuff moved people that worked for the president.
Right.
And it would, and it kind of served as a guiding light to the president in some moments too. And, you know, I read the article and I'm bawling as well. And Paul said something that I'll never forget, which is, we have to do this. This is what we have to do, which is we have to make sure that people that work for elected officials understand the impact that their decisions are having on their constituency. They have to understand, because that stuff will transfer over to their bosses. It'll be harder for them to conduct business as usual. And maybe in the same way, this can be a guiding light. And so with that, we kind of set out, just not really knowing where it would take us. We put out a call to action and said, look, we had this idea. If you want us, meaning Paul, me, and then our colleague Jennifer Flynn, who works for Center for Popular Democracy, if you want us to come out and train you on how to talk to your elected officials, whether it's at a public setting like a town hall, whether it's going to their office and telling them your story, or whether it's in a demonstration, call us and let us know wherever you are. If you can get 15 or 20 people together, we're going to try to find a way to come to you. And within a few days, we had 60 requests from different cities. Fast forward to now. Between the three of us, and I would say Paul has more than handled his fair share of these. We've held so many trainings, held trainings in 25 or 26 states, and have trained more than 1,200 activists since February to tell their stories to their elected officials. And a lot of these folks are new activists. These aren't people that have been doing this for a long time. They're just concerned citizens that are really worried about the direction that our country's headed in, and are really worried about things like losing their health care.
Yeah.
So with that, you know, just developing relationships, when things started getting closer, when the repeal of the Affordable Care Act and cuts to Medicaid, as they became more of a reality instead of just a possibility, conference calls started to bubble up, and people thought that it'd be a good idea for us just to all converge in Washington, D.C. and continue to take the message to our elected officials at home. Whether it's at town halls or whether it's in their offices, just make sure that they know exactly what's going on in the lives of their constituents.
Right. Right. And so looking forward, now Mitch McConnell says that they're going to stay in and keep working for the first 2 weeks of the August recess. What's coming next?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. We're not going away, that's for sure. We're gonna, as long as they are threatening to take away healthcare for more than 20 million people, as long as they're threatening the lives, and I can't remember how many lives per year this will cost us, but thousands of lives per year, people who will die if they don't have access to healthcare. As long as that's going on, I can't see us going away. I think McConnell said something about activist fatigue or some sort of fatigue. We don't have anything left if they take this away from us. So we're not getting tired and we're not going anywhere. Our lives depend on it. There were a number, there was one person, who was arrested at the demonstration on Monday, who has severe medical issues and was hospitalized after she was jailed. And I think that some people might say, well, she's got so many important and serious medical issues, why is she out there protesting? That's because her life's at stake if we lose access to healthcare. She doesn't know how she's going to be able to make her doctor's appointments if her access to healthcare is cut off. So, sure, she might endanger herself by doing these protests, but the prospects don't look very much better if she loses access to healthcare. And I think a lot of people understand that and are energized by that. So I'm not exactly sure what the next step is going to be. I know that it might come as early as Monday of next week. It might come at the end of this month, but it's coming, and we are not going away. We're going to continue to tell our stories to our elected officials.
Yeah. How can people keep up with you, and how can they get involved if they want to take part in some of this?
Well, I mean, I think that one way to do it is by visiting our website, www.housingworks.org. That's our organizational site. You can make a donation to us. It's when we decide to send activists to Washington, D.C., and when we decide that, you know, that we're going to risk arrest, that's kind of expensive. It does cost money, so you can sponsor protesters by donating. I think the other thing that people can do is just, I'll do something crazy and just say, you can email me about how to get more involved in this at j.benjamin, like Benjamin Franklin, at housingworks.org. So that's j.benjamin@housingworks.org. To figure out how to get involved, you know, whether it's getting trained and learning some tactics that activists have used in the past, or getting involved in some of the stuff that we've got going on both in D.C. and in districts around the country. Hit us up and we'll try to put you in touch with the right people, and maybe together we can do the impossible, which is save the healthcare that we've got, and maybe even push our elected officials to make improvements to the programs that we've got right now.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.